Support for this podcast comes from the Fletcher School of Global Affairs at Tufts University. To start your future as a global changemaker, you must have context across fields like international business, cybersecurity, energy policy, and more. Don't just study global affairs, shape them. Visit fletcher.tufts.edu. Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week, Democrats in debate. U.S. troops will stay at strength in Afghanistan. Deadly violence in Jerusalem. Democratic presidential contenders squared off in Las Vegas Tuesday night. Despite their differences, Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton found some common ground.
The secretary is right. And that is that the American people are sick and tired of hearing about your damn emails.
Thank you. Me too.
Yesterday, the White House announced thousands of U.S. troops will stay in Afghanistan beyond the end of Barack Obama's time in office. Indefinitely, it's not what he wanted, but here's the president.
This modest but meaningful extension of our presence, while sticking to our current narrow missions, can make a real difference. It's the right thing to do.
And a wave of deadly Palestinian knife attacks and Israeli response sweeps Jerusalem. Here's NBC News.
A man with a knife runs past a security checkpoint and is shot dead by Israeli police. The knife clearly visible in his hand.
This hour, On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Howard Feynman of The Huffington Post, Nicole Gouette of Bloomberg News, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see in the news from Afghanistan, Jerusalem, the Democrats in Las Vegas? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We will be reading. Joining me now from Washington is Howard Feynman, editorial director at the Huffington Post Media Group. Howard, welcome back to On Point.
Great to be here. Thank you.
And in Washington, Nicole Gouette, foreign policy reporter at Bloomberg News. Nicole Gouette, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Tom. Hi.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Howard, and Nicole.
Let's go straight to the president at the White House yesterday, saying the United States now plans to halt his earlier, more full withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. 5,500, we're told, will stay on past next year.
Their mission will not change. Our troops will continue to pursue those two narrow tasks that I outlined earlier, training Afghan forces and going after al-Qaeda.
And here's Defense Secretary Ash Carter following up in a press conference yesterday on that decision.
We're adjusting our presence based on conditions on the ground to give the United States and our allies the capability to sustain a robust counterterrorism platform, denying a safe haven for terrorist and violent extremist organizations.
Howard Feynman, remind us how central to the Obama promise getting out of Iraq and Afghanistan was 8 years ago.
Well, it's central to his entire public life. It's how he, in essence, became president. It was by promising not to make dumb decisions about stupid wars in places where we couldn't win in reaction to the Bush years that he rose and became president. And it is the organizing principle, I think, of his presidency. And what he's saying here is that it's really tough and really complicated, and we can't disengage fully. And I think it's very significant.
Nicole, what do you make of it? The circumstances on the ground, I mean, this was a long time coming. They stuck to the notion of drawing down over the next year and being down to embassy guards, as the president more or less liked to say, 1,000 plus, but still, by late 2016, 2017, and now that's not happening. We saw Kunduz. We've seen the maps out from the UN this week about the Taliban all over the place. What are they facing that forced them, I guess you'd have to presume, to this decision?
Yeah, there are a number of factors. So originally the plan was to have about 1,000 or less U.S. troops deployed around Kabul, Kabul around the end of 2016. And now we're going to keep the current force posture of 9,800 through the end of next year. And they hope to draw down in January 2017 to about 5,500 in four places. There are a whole bunch of factors going into this decision, and I think it was a very tough one for the administration. But as you said, the UN came out with a report recently showing that the Taliban has spread through more parts of the country than at any other point since 2001. And we saw just a few weeks ago, they easily overran a key city in the north, Kunduz, without much trouble. And the Afghan forces, which are responsible now for combat missions, were pretty ineffectual. That was a strong signal that maybe it's too early for the Americans to pull out. We've also had Pentagon officials pushing hard for a long time to have the president give the Afghans more support. They could clearly see that there were issues. We also have a different Afghan president. I think in the past there was a lot of uncertainty and maybe even distrust of the former Afghan president Karzai, who is seen as mercurial and a little hard to deal with. We now have a president, President Ghani, who is, I think, seen as much more reliable. When he came to Washington in March, he made a point of going to the Pentagon to thank troops for their service. He visited Arlington Cemetery to honor the dead, and I think that was hugely appreciated. But I think the biggest factor behind this decision has been the fact that we're beginning to see a nascent Islamic State presence in Afghanistan and the lessons of Iraq. We pulled our troop presence down there in 2011, and since then we've just been dealing with a conflagration as large parts of the country have fallen out of government control, and we now face the threat of this transnational, highly organized, well-financed terrorist group.
And they have been making their presence known, still marginal compared to the Taliban, but nevertheless in Afghanistan. I mean, Jack, that's hard to look away from. Takes us back to the arguments for this war all the way back in 2001, longest in U.S. history now. But when we first went in, look at it now. Imagine an ISIS kind of situation in Afghanistan with Pakistan right next door with all of its own, you know, tinderbox dynamics and nuclear weapons. I mean, what do you see in this, Jack? Is the president reinforcing failure by staying in? Is he buying time for the government to step up, the Afghan government, and secure the country?
Well, you know, Tom, Harold Macmillan, the British prime minister, said the first rule of politics is don't invade Afghanistan. And it's been 14 years.
That was a while back.
It was a while back.
I'd love to hear the name Harold Macmillan, yes. Especially from Jack.
Seldom uttered.
But, you know, it's been 14 years now since we invaded. And under the Taliban, Afghanistan was at peace. Now, well, last year set the record for Afghan civilians killed. This year, likely to be worse. The American commander says Afghan troops control the strategic ring road. Afghan officials say the Taliban repeatedly cut it. President Obama said the Afghans have fought well. They have suffered high casualties. But in Kunduz, 7,000 Afghan security forces were routed by 500 Taliban. Now, the president says the additional U.S. troops are partly for more training. But training is sedative rhetoric meant to lull us into forgetting that Obama is not only buying time for the Afghans, he's really buying time for himself. He wants to keep the worst from happening until after he leaves office.
So, but what are you saying, Jack? Go on, Barack, stick to your guns. Pull out of there? I mean, can you see the black flags over Afghanistan and Pakistan next door looking at an ISIS on its border?
Well, that's another question. I think that...
Is it?
The question is Afghanistan a vital U.S. security interest? And I think this question about terrorist training camps and the rest, I think that's just more sedative rhetoric meant to obscure the fact that the terrorists now are everywhere and they don't need to be in one location in Afghanistan. And I do think history will look back on this and see that this was far from being a necessary war, a misbegotten and now seemingly endless intervention.
Howard, how do you see it? Terrorist training camps in itself now sounds a little dated when you've got ISIS on the move. These aren't training camps. They're taking over and declaring a state. They'd like to no doubt extend their caliphate to Afghanistan. Does that make the president right here, or is he just, as Jack says, covering his tail until he can get out of office?
Well, I think it's, I'm checking myself. I don't want to be cynical. I don't want to be a traditional cynical political reporter, but I have to say that this is a CYA effort here. I don't think anybody thinks they're going to turn the situation around in Afghanistan anytime soon, if ever. And I think the president doesn't want a very visible, dramatic
collapse.
Fall of Saigon kind
yes,
of scene.
Yes, he doesn't want that kind of thing before he leaves office. I mean, he has staked his whole philosophy and his whole administration on this kind of intelligent engagement, shrewd engagement, military, but finely honed and finely detailed. And it's really not working any better than the bombs away methods of George W. Bush. And I don't think he would like to see vivid evidence of that before he leaves office.
You've got Republicans and others now talking about treating it like South Korea or Germany or Japan, where U.S. troops stayed for decades after the war. Of course, they were peaceful by the time those long-term dynamics kicked in. Ken in Ticonderoga, New York. Ken, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Disappointed. As a Vietnam vet who served at the end, 72-73, the handwriting was on the wall then. It has been for years in Afghanistan. If those people don't want it, we can't want it for them. Stop getting American kids killed. Stop wasting American treasure and blood.
Ken, we've got it. Voice of Vietnam era speaking there to the Afghan era. Nicole Gawet, how about it? You look at that UN map. Is there a way, a credible way, that this can actually, with a little more support, work out? That UN map that shows Taliban all over the place already with almost 10,000 troops on the ground.
Well, it's hard to see. It's an enormous challenge. And it's, you know, military families across America have really borne the brunt with people doing up to 5 deployments, leaving, yeah. you know, husbands and wives and kids behind. And it's a real dilemma. I mean, one of the things that Ash Carter stressed in that press conference was that there is a national security threat to American interests. And we've seen what happens when a group, a terrorist group, can take a failed state and use it to plan and launch terrorist attacks. And I think that's a real concern. I think Howard and Jack are right. I mean, there's a lot of sort of image management going on, and it's not the kind of problem you can wrap up in a neat bow mm-hmm. Before the next president steps in. And it's going to be interesting to see how this plays out in coming Republican and Democratic debates. But, it's a thorny one.
It's all fluid now. Once you take away that we'll get out and that number, I've heard commentators this week saying, well, we'll go to 5,500, but it could go up again. We could have another surge. We could be in there for real for a long, long time. Nicole Gawet with Bloomberg News, foreign policy reporter there. Howard Fineman with Huffington Post. Jack Beatty, please stand by. We're looking at a week in the news. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Looking at a week in the news this hour, U.S. troops will stay on in Afghanistan. The Democrats debate violence in Jerusalem and beyond. Howard Fineman is with us from Huffington Post Media Group, editorial director there, AOL Huffington Post. Nicole Gawet is with us, foreign policy reporter for Bloomberg News. Jack Beatty's here. And you can join us at this week's end after their debate. How are you looking at the Democrats, Clinton, Sanders, who's speaking to you among the Republicans this week? And yes, we'll look at Jerusalem as well. Why has it come to this in Israel? Palestinians stabbing Israelis in the streets of Jerusalem, Israelis shooting down assailants in the streets of Jerusalem, the trouble now in Nablus and beyond. We've got lots of online response to Afghanistan, and most of it not happy. Incredibly disappointing, writes one listener. We have another Vietnam on our hands. I guess it's safe to say we've learned nothing, but history goes on, so do challenges. I want to turn to that debate in Las Vegas. There they were, just 5, not 10 or 11 or 15 or 20, like the Republicans, 10 or 11 like the Republicans. It was an interesting night. Bernie Sanders up there in his first big national debate, and in his opening statement, it wasn't biography. He went straight at his big theme on inequality in America's middle class.
The middle class of this country for the last 40 years has been disappearing. Millions of Americans are working longer hours for lower wages, and yet almost all of the new income and wealth being created is going to the top 1%.
There's the Sanders message, and it has drawn big crowds across the country. Hillary with decent crowds herself this week. Manny saying she performed very well in this debate. And here she was after Anderson Cooper, with Bernie Sanders there, asked her whether she was a progressive or a moderate. Here's Clinton.
I'm a progressive. But I'm a progressive who likes to get things done. And I know how to find common ground. And I know how to stand my ground. And I have proved that in every position that I've had, even dealing with Republicans who never had a good word to say about me, honestly.
All right, Howard Fineman, step back, look at these five, look at these two, and in the context of the Republican challenge, what did you see in Vegas?
Well, I thought your soundbite summarized it beautifully. I think there's not a lot of deep conflict ideologically, although you might argue that you heard a debate about capitalism versus socialism for the first time in a long time in a Democratic or any debate. But really, what Bernie and Hillary are disagreeing about is his intensity and passion on that issue and doing something about the middle class. And Hillary saying, I agree with you, but I can get it done better than you could. So it's passion versus mechanics on really, really the same goal. And I think both of them helped themselves and in a way each other by making that the central argument. And that was what the debate was all about.
I mean, I wonder if it's exactly on the same goal. Anderson Cooper tried to hone in on this, talking with Bernie Sanders about what he meant by democratic socialism, and Bernie bringing up a lot of Scandinavian countries, and Denmark got a big workout in this debate. when he pushed Hillary Clinton on this front, I'm not sure it was the same goal. Bernie seemed more willing to mess with the checkerboard here. Hillary seemed more committed to what we've seen. In this clip, she talks about what capitalism has done for Americans.
It's our job to rein in the excesses of capitalism so that it doesn't run amok and doesn't cause the kind of inequities that we're seeing in our economic system. But we would be making a grave mistake to turn our backs on what built the greatest middle class in the history
Senator
of the
Sanders.
World.
Senator Sanders.
Jack Beatty, what did you hear in this debate?
Well, you know, going into the debate, I thought Bernie Sanders had three challenges. Ideologically, and this goes to Howard's point, to show that his socialism was democratic with a capital D, a new edition of the New Deal. And tonally, to shed a little of the sanctimony that can make socialists really sound like scolds. Politically, to bid for the minority vote. How did he do? Well, as you say, Tom, he invoked Denmark as his lodestar, not the New Deal. And at least to my ear, he still sounded as if he not only wanted to convert capitalists, but make them repent. On the minority front, I think he made a strong statement about why Black Lives Matter, but that's not likely to be enough. I mean, he's close to Hillary in Iowa, fourth whitest state, ahead in New Hampshire, sixth whitest. Meanwhile, a new poll from South Carolina shows he's trailing Hillary Clinton 4% to 59% among the minority voters who make up half the Democratic electorate. On Super Tuesday, a week after South Carolina, he's likely to be crushed in the eight contests across Dixie. You know, Bernie Sanders doesn't look like Gary Hart. His politics aren't like Paul Tsongas's, but his voters look like theirs, college students and white college-educated progressives. Recall that Toni Morrison called Bill Clinton the first black president. Now that President Obama isn't running, the Democratic South is Clinton country, and it's likely to make her the nominee.
Yes, Howard, please.
The best tactical hope that Bernie has to answer the on the landscape that Jack painted is if Joe Biden gets in the race. If that happens, Joe Biden's going to have big appeal among African American voters, starting in South Carolina, where he would need the support of Jim Clyburn, the very powerful African American congressman from Columbia.
Yep.
That would change the equation. But if Biden doesn't get in, and I'm literally being driven crazy by Joe Biden at this very minute.
Come on, Joe. Come on.
I'm almost over the edge. If Biden doesn't get in, I think Jack's absolutely right.
Nicole, I don't know. I mean, that may be the cold calculus. On the other hand, it seemed to me that given his message, Bernie Sanders comported himself pretty well, strong. He looked steady. And if American disillusion with what we've seen in the economy in the last decade and more is strong enough, he didn't seem to come across as a crank up there. He seems to be speaking for many.
Not at all. I was going to say, what struck me was how deeply his message is resonating. And I wanted to ask Jack and Howard, who follow this much more closely than I do, whether they think he got into this race with the idea that he actually had a shot and could do very well, or whether he got into the race because he wanted to push Clinton hard on these issues and move her from the solid center where she seems to rest a little more to the left and to be a little more active on issues like income inequality and so
on. Well, I can actually answer that question as I often am unable to do with real knowledge. Okay,
and hey, listen up.
Listen to this.
Frame this.
A year ago, I think it was about a year ago, Bernie's press guy, Mike Briggs, who I've known for a long time, called me and said, come on up, Bernie would love to talk. And that was a little unusual. And he didn't really want to talk about the Veterans Affairs Committee. He wanted to talk about running for president. And I wrote a piece in the Huffington Post saying, you know, weirder things have happened. Bernie's going to run, or words to that effect. And I can tell you from that conversation, which lasted a long time, that he wasn't thinking about Hillary Clinton at all.
Wow.
He was thinking that he, Bernie Sanders, saw an opening and that he was going to drive his truck through it and that he had a shot. This is a guy who's always been underestimated, going back to when he first ran for mayor of Burlington, Vermont, and then Congress, and then the House, and then the Senate, and so forth. In his mind, he thought he had a shot to get elected from the very start.
There was something very steady and magnanimous, especially in the email comment, but in general about him up there, and it was striking to me. Let's hear from our listeners and what they saw. Anne in Boston. Anne, you're on the air.
Hi. I love your show. So before the debate, I had been really, I had decided I'm going to go with Bernie Sanders. I think his message is important. The country needs a significant change, and he knows what that is. Then during the debate, I just kind of felt like he didn't have the knowledge, the confidence. It's a complicated world, and I felt like, you know, I think Hillary is in a better position to be president. And there was one moment in which Jim Webb had made a comment about China and cyber warfare, and Anderson Cooper said to Bernie Sanders, what do you think? And Bernie Sanders wasn't listening, and he didn't follow up.
Maybe he had his eyes on the prize, Anne. No, I mean, but I know what you mean. It, on his main theme, incredibly strong. Given his message, that is not a traditionally easy message to carry into American politics, and I thought he did it quite formidably. But, Jack, you look off that page, at least Anne does, and sees Hillary as having, you know, navigating more waters more adroitly.
It certainly seemed that way, and I know exactly what Ann means. And Bernie even imputed to Hillary a position she didn't hold on, putting more. I don't want to put more troops, he said, into Syria. I'll put any troops into Syria, and she said, well, I don't recommend that either. Yes, he did seem uncertain on foreign policy. On the other hand, he made, I think, the capital point and the point that Barack sort of brought Barack Obama into politics and that he's since forgotten, which is foreign intervention is the end of domestic reform. If you want to go abroad into adventures and spend $1 trillion, you're not going to be able to do the things at home that Bernie wants to do.
More callers. Bob in Oklahoma, Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air.
Yeah, thank you. What I want to say is that this race is really between the more authoritarian leadership with Hillary versus the more democratic, people-oriented leadership with Bernie. And the Republicans don't even have a dog in this fight. And really, the whole situation goes down like this with the debate. The response from the American public is quite clear. Bernie is the clear victor. I wonder why that's not going ahead and being stated on the air.
Bob, we got it. I don't think I heard him written off, but there was a lot of Hillary wins. It was a sparkling performance by Hillary, whether she gets your vote or not, and many others. Nick in Clawson, Michigan. Nick, you're on the air.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. I just want to say CNN declared Hillary the winner, but Time Warner is Hillary's fourth largest contributor, so maybe there's something there. But more importantly, At one point during the debate, you remember Bernie saying, "We're sick of your damn emails," and the crowd gave him a standing ovation. That was the only time during the entire debate that I saw that any candidate got a standing ovation. And nobody has mentioned that yet of any news outlet I've heard talk about the debate.
Nick, I have seen it written, but I take your point. Of course, why would everybody stand for that? Because Bernie looked magnanimous and he cleared Hillary, or tried to, or gave her a shot at clearing from one of her most onerous scandals lately, if you will. Jack, what about Bernie's very big sweep away the emails moment there for Hillary?
Well, writing in the Washington Post this morning, Charles Krauthammer said he just gave away the election. That was his one issue to sort of work against her. You're not trusted, Hillary. You can't win for that reason.
Is that cynical punditry that Howard doesn't want to be part of, Jack? The American people saying, you're right, we have bigger issues than email?
Well, you know, I think that, I mean, it fits Bernie. I mean, Howard would know this better than I do, but I sense that he's always been an issue man. He's always been about the issues and about the American common wheel, and not about, slanging politics, hitting other guy.
That's true, but
that's exactly right.
Oh, sorry.
And we now have, sorry for speaking over you, Republicans coming out and saying that the committee to investigate Benghazi, which has become the committee to investigate the emails, is politically driven. And I think that ovation that Nick's talking about reflects this incredible frustration across the country with Congress's inability to get anything of substance done, but great willingness to sling political mud.
Well, we'll see next week how the country responds to the Benghazi hearings with Hillary in the hot seat. What about it, Howard, that moment?
Well, it couldn't be set up better for Hillary to survive it than it is right now. Thanks in part to Kevin McCarthy, former candidate for House Speaker, and Bernie Sanders, and Hillary's own confidence. And I would add marginally what President Obama said on 60 Minutes the other day.
He wasn't laudatory. He
wasn't laudatory, but he said, look, she made a mistake and she said so. She shouldn't have set up that private system. We all have to be very careful. But then he went on to say, we're not looking at a situation here where there was any threat to national security. He did say that.
FBI is investigating right now.
Right, which was an important addendum from the President of the United States. And I know that President Obama himself thought he was, I've been told by somebody who had a conversation with him just the other night, that he thought he was doing Hillary a favor there with that comment. And he took credit for his what he regarded as a defense of Hillary on that. Now,
pitching in.
It's interesting.
Yeah, let's get a call here from Umbria in Italy, no less. Bella Italia, Jim is calling. Hi, Jim, you're on the air across the pond.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi, Tom. Full disclosure, I'm a Democrat who wants to see any Democrat elected, primarily to protect the progress we've made on social issues and because of the importance of the Supreme Court nominations.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'd like to hear your panel's comments on two thoughts I've had. One, Hillary's choosing a moderate Republican as a running mate, perhaps like John Kasich. And number two, Biden offering himself up as a one-term president as a way of healing the nation.
Well, I don't think she'll utter those words while the primaries are on. That would drive people crazy. How about it, Howard?
Well, the one-term president idea is, I don't know whether they've discussed that within the incredibly tight innermost circle of Joe Biden's team. But I think that would be a provocative and interesting one. And
why would that be appealing? I mean, does that mean that the rest of the field is so unappealing that to have Joe Biden?
Well, he has to have some special rationale.
Yeah, but what's special about that? I'll come in for 4 years. Why is that in and of itself appealing?
Because I think if he offered himself as some kind of coalition government guy, that might be an interesting way to go.
That would win him the Democratic nomination?
I don't know. I'm just trying to think of what what his pitch is going to be if he gets in. I talked about his ties to the African American community and the notion that he would be specifically running as President Obama's guy. This would be another interesting aspect to that theory.
What, Jack, how about it? Hillary picks a moderate Republican as a running mate?
I think she may have picked her running mate yesterday in San Antonio. Is it Joaquin Castro? Yes.
One of those Castro brothers.
One of those Castro brothers, yeah.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. In other news this week, a double suicide bombing at a Saturday peace rally in Ankara, Turkey, left nearly 100 people dead, hundreds more injured, and Turkey in shock and anger. Chicago Cubs pitcher Hector Rondon struck out Cardinals left fielder Stephen Piscotty for the first ever postseason clinch at Wrigley Field, getting the team one step closer to the World Series. Last time they won a World Series, 1908.
He got him! A strikeout! The Cubs win! The Chicago Cubs are heading to the National League Championship Series!
And Playboy says no more nudes. The magazine announced this week it will stop publishing naked photos. Just too many of them on the web already. Nothing special there. Daily Show host Trevor Noah joked about the change with correspondent Jessica Williams.
No nudity in Playboy?
Mm-mm.
Yes! More space for the articles! Yes! Words are so sexy. Mm.
Ew.
Multiple
ew.
Syllables.
Ew. Take it easy. Ew.
Ew is what she has to say there. We're looking at a week in the news. U.S. troops will stay in Afghanistan. The Democrats debate violence in Jerusalem and beyond. Nicole Gouette is with us from Bloomberg News, foreign policy reporter there. Howard Feynman's here from AOL Huffington Post Media Group, Global Editorial Director, no less. Jack Beatty is with us, On Point News Analyst, and you can join us as well. What are you thinking on the Russians and Syria? Did you hear John Kerry talking about that today on Morning Edition, about the bloodshed attacks and shooting down of attackers in the streets of Jerusalem, and now that trouble spreading beyond? Going to move on here to Jerusalem and Israel, but we've got still some response on politics. Maria says, Jack, not so sure about your Hillary sweeping the South. Speaking as a South Carolinian, I can assure you that South Carolina may have been Bill's, but it's not Hillary's. We will see what's coming there. All over there. We've got callers on many fronts. Let's go to Will in Austin, Texas. Will, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. My question is about the story concerning the recent violence in Jerusalem. It seems to me that a lot of the media reporting on this has kind of framed this issue as a situation in which Palestinians are randomly attacking Israelis with knives and Israelis are defending themselves with guns. I'm curious to know if you and your panel think that that's a fair way to frame the issue, especially considering that this really all began when the Israeli police attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the last couple of weeks, and also considering the fact that last time I checked, the death toll for Israelis was 7 and for Palestinians was 30. And I'll also mention that people living in the West Bank, Palestinians living in the West Bank, have been living under the constant threat of attacks from settler terrorists. And I'm wondering if you think that this is a wise way to frame the issue, the way that it's been portrayed.
Well, we've got it, and we'll pick it straight up there. I mean, Nicole Gouette, just on the facts, and it may not be the frame, the scope of frame that Will wants to put around this, but it is quite true that a lot of young Palestinians have been with knives in Jerusalem attacking Israelis. And the latest numbers I have here are 8 Israelis killed in the past month. But also the ratio, more or less, as you say, 32 Palestinians killed by Israeli fire, including 15 labeled by Israel as attackers. This is making a lot of people very uncomfortable. Nicole Gouette, what's the right frame to put around this?
You know, Tom, I was just thinking that my very first conversations with you were back during the Second Intifada when I was based in Jerusalem.
Yeah.
And then, as now, the way this story is written about almost always comes in for criticism. It's such a fraught story. And it's tragic that it essentially hasn't changed. I mean, the news today coming out of Jerusalem coming out of Israel was about the burning of a compound which contains the tomb of the biblical patriarch Joseph.
And this is not
fire.
Mary and Joseph, Joseph. This is way back, ancient biblical Joseph. Okay.
The old guy.
Yeah.
So it was put out by, you know, Palestinian security forces. It was condemned by Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas. There were no deaths, and I believe there were no injuries. But there was a lot of physical damage, and probably worse, it's, you know, it's going to be seen as a desecration and probably trigger retaliation.
An important site for Jews and Israelis.
Yes, absolutely. One of the interesting things about the attacks that you and Will have mentioned, young Palestinians, is that a lot of analysts on the ground are saying they're not being organized or directed by Palestinian militant factions or groups the way they used to be. And a lot of these kids seem driven by social media, which is something we saw elsewhere in the Middle East with the uprisings. Mm-hmm. But it makes this harder to contain, even more unpredictable than it's been in the past. And maybe even more dangerous.
And now beyond Jerusalem, not just at the Tomb of Joseph, but the latest I see here from the Associated Press in Ramallah, also outside Jerusalem in the West Bank, Palestinian man wearing a yellow vest with the word press written on it, shot and killed by Israeli soldiers after stabbing and wounding a soldier. Howard, what do you see here? I mean, Intifada was one thing. It was kind of, there were exhortations. Palestinians came out. They rose up. They were very difficult to handle last time. And before there were suicide bombings. But this time, knives in hands, it may be social media driven. It's very hard to respond when it's so dispersed, but still lethal.
Well, let me ask a factual question. Is it true, as the caller said, that the Israeli, quote, the Israeli police attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque?
That, I'm glad you returned to that.
Is that true?
I have not seen attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque. There has been...
Well, what do we think here on the panel? Do we know?
This whole wave of violence began last month over the Jewish New Year with rumors that Israel was going to try and take over the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And for listeners who don't know, it's in the center of the Old City of Jerusalem. It's the most sensitive holy mm-hmm. site there. It's
third holiest site in Islam, called Temple
exactly.
Mount by Jews.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the Temple Mount was the site of the first and second Jewish temple. So, you know, mm-hmm. places that are
big
deeply
deal.
Important, millennia old. So those were rumors, but that's all they were. But they triggered protests that became violent, and so there was no attack, but there was something we've seen before.
Part of the problem here is when people call up and say as fact that, quote, the Israeli police attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
It
wasn't true.
Howard, facts are important, and I was determined to come back to that. On the other hand, Al-Aqsa Mosque is an issue. Let's put the
no. There's no question about that. There's no question about that. And as to social media and what's going on there, I don't have firsthand information about it. I'm not there. But my understanding is, and again, tell me if I'm wrong, that Hamas is very active in terms of social media and just, you know, cheerleading, if you will, in this whole situation. And again, if I'm right or if I'm wrong, please tell me. But Hamas and Iran are very closely aligned these days. My view of it in a macro sense is that the mullahs, having decided to cross their fingers and take the deal with the United States on nukes, are trying to show their supporters and their own people where their hearts are. By supporting Hamas here, and I think that's part of the equation that we need to look at about what's going on there. Am I totally off base? Please tell me.
Nicole, I mean, do you have to look all the way to Tehran to find kindling here?
I think there is certainly a lot of concern within Israel and beyond about Iran's regional activities. But certainly Hamas, like many other group, is active on social media. But they're, I mean... Twitter,
aren't they the
Facebook.
Main ones calling
it's
for the day of a day of rage
all,
and so forth?
All kinds of groups are active. To answer Tom's question directly, and actually to cite Secretary Kerry, who spoke to this just the other day and mm-hmm. this morning, mm-hmm. You know, there are all kinds of frustrations on both sides. You certainly don't need an Iran or a Hamas to get a young Palestinian angry about their inability to move from point A to point B, or to get a young Israeli frustrated that they can't walk down their streets in safety and that they're, you know, generations later, there is still no peace.
Let's hear from a couple of the central players here. Here's tape from Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He was talking about the current wave of violence in a speech to the Knesset on Monday. And he goes right to this issue where people may have very different interpretations of what's going on. But here's the Netanyahu view. And I'll have to interpret this. He says, I mean, I'm reading here. We must understand once and for all, Netanyahu says, terror does not come from frustration because there is not a peace process. Terror comes from the desire to annihilate us. Jack, that's a very big assertion here. Many people would say, well, who wouldn't understand frustration when peace process has been so moribund? And we saw what happened in Gaza, and you've got settlers upon settlers in the West Bank. But Netanyahu says, no, it's about the annihilation urge.
Well, you know, the Huffington Post this morning quotes the head of a nonprofit in Jerusalem that looks at issues that could affect a two-state solution. And this man, Daniel Seideman, says, quote, never before in my memory has there been such a total absence of any sense of hope on the political horizon. Right. In other words, these local, what Howard says is probably true about Hamas, but the dynamics in the first place are local and rooted
in this
immense frustration on both sides.
Let me throw this one in just on the same point. Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas, he was talking on Wednesday here and looks at the waves of violence in Jerusalem. But what he points to is racism, he says, against Palestinians. This is interpreted by Euronews.
These days, the Israeli aggressive assault against our people, its land, and its holy places is escalating. The racism is showing its ugly face and is making the occupation uglier.
Let's hear from our listeners, Kathy, in Watertown, Massachusetts. Kathy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I can't tell you how upset I am. I'm Jewish. I grew up with the Zionist lies, and I was a Zionist. I went to the West Bank in 2008, and I can tell you that it is the Palestinians who are the victims. If you rob me and rape me and I scratch you back to defend myself, who's the victim? The rapist?
So what should Netanyahu be doing when Israelis are dying in the streets, stabbed?
They should clear all of the illegal settlers out of the West Bank. They should take down the checkpoints that stop Palestinians from getting from one neighborhood of their own town to another. That separation wall is not about security. If it were about security, it would follow the Green Line, which was the so-called 1967 armistice line.
Yep.
The fact is, 75% of that wall is in the occupied West Bank.
Kathy, we've got it, and we hear your passion on it as well. We're looking at A Week in the News. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Listen, giant issues here. We're going to talk more about this on Monday. This one is tough to settle, and maybe literally tough to settle, with this element of, call it what you will, Howard or Nicole, but there appears to be a more spontaneous, molecular kind of dynamic to this. Yes, it may be encouraged and inflamed, but there's also obvious sources of frustration here and now, individual actors in the streets. We will see how this one plays out.
Tom, can I just say, Nicole, just to flag for all your listeners who are interested, that we may actually see more of an effort from the administration to get back in and try and do something. Secretary Kerry has been hinting very broadly about the fact that the administration is deeply concerned that even the possibility of a two-state solution could be lost.
May I just share my immediate response to that, which is that seems hopeless. I mean, what administration has made progress here? 20 years since Rabin died. What progress has John Kerry made here?
I will just say that Secretary Kerry seems to be a man of enormous confidence. I think he believes.
Well, he travels a lot.
It can't hurt to try.
As he actually just said, in
your part of the world the other day, that most people have a pretty good sense of exactly what has to be done and where this has to go. It's just a question of making the judgments and having the guts to do it.
Howard, one more on this, and then I want to get a little bit to Syria.
Okay, just very quickly, I agree with the caller based on what I've seen from a long distance about what the right wing in Israel has done. They've made it much more difficult to achieve peace, and John Kerry may say all that, but my sense of it is, and we've been reporting also, that the Europeans and the French are trying to lead their own effort. Maybe that's a way to get the Americans back in the ballgame. I'm skeptical.
I don't want to mock John Kerry's determination. I wish him luck with it. But boy, it is a tough, tough nut. We've only got a couple of minutes here. We heard John Kerry talking with Steve Inskeep on Morning Edition today. And among the head-turning things he said, Nicole, was he said about Vladimir Putin, he is not going to be able to stop the war by being there. To win this thing, is that a veiled threat from John Kerry? We're going to pump in arms. There's no way Putin was going to be able to settle this down.
I think it's just a statement of fact. I mean, if any country can speak to the experience of going into a third place with a large number of troops to try and change the situation on the ground, it's us. You know, he has plunked himself in the middle of a very ugly sectarian war. On the side, very clearly on the side of the regime. And we already see Gulf countries making pronouncements about how if Russia stays and continues to help President Bashar al-Assad, who is a Shiite, they will step in and do more to help Sunni rebels.
Forgive me, then, our time is so short. But Kerry also said in this deconfliction conversations he's having with Sergei Lavrov, that maybe we can turn it around and get the Russians lined up with the U.S. against ISIS instead of just defending Assad. Is that delusional?
Ooh, it's hopeful. It's hopeful. Russia's clearly not attacking Islamic State on by itself. They're also very clearly going after rebels that the U.S. supports. It's a murky business, and I think that's a bit of a stretch.
We will support the hopes of John Kerry and keep a very clear eye on what's really going on at the same time. Nicole Gawet, it's good to have you back with us. It's been too long. Please come again.
Thank you.
Nicole Gawet, foreign policy reporter for Bloomberg News. Howard Fineman with AOL Huffington Post Media Group Global Editorial Director. The suzerain of all that happens.
It's an embarrassing title.
But it's yours, baby.
Okay.
Thank you for joining us, Howard.
Thank you.
And Jack Beatty, it's always good to have you right here. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue the conversation. Get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.